I don't know how much of our communication goes to the general population, the emails back and forth about. Okay. As you will recall, in the beginning of the new year, I made suggestions that we do make a commitment to this year. And one of those suggestions was social engagement. And Marina and Bernie have looked into this, and we have talked together about it. So what I'd like to do today is I'm going to mention some aspects of how social engagement wound up as a part of practice, and then use the practice circle period to talk about it so that we can get a feeling about everybody else's view about this particular issue. Probably over the many years that I've been a teacher now, you know this, but just for people that are not all that familiar about my background and how come I have this interest over time. Occupationally, I sort of just by accident wound up working for a social service agency when I was looking for a job and actually wound up staying there for my entire work life. And a major portion of what I did there was social work. And much of that social work had to do with working to people and families in poverty. And so over time, I became an expert with a small e in all the different variations that go into somebody being homeless, particularly the services that are in the community, the money that's available to help them with their living circumstances. And I also knew a lot about how the landlord-tenant cases worked in court. And it always occurred to me that if somebody could get involved, that you could work a lot of these cases out between the landlord and tenant. And both ways, it would be sort of an even playing field. We knew a lot about the landlord abuses and also knew ways where we could help the tenants who had been deficient in paying their rent. So, this is probably too long already. But anyway, so the court asked somebody from social service to come there to provide information about the different programs. And somewhere along the way, I was in the judge's chambers and I said, you know, we could, because, and the court was crowded with people. You could imagine, this is in Paterson, New Jersey. So, in talking to the judge, I had suggested that if he had another fellow that came with me, if he had had us trained as mediators, we could probably take care of it at least a third, if not a half, of these cases so they wouldn't have to be heard by the judge. He could just sign off on the settlement. So that was my first step into social engagement. And around the same time, Bernie Glassman was my teacher, and he was changing from being a conventional Zen master to becoming much more involved in social action. And so, you know, the first area that he got involved with was homelessness, which happened to be the same thing that I was involved in. So, I got involved as one of the many people that did it with him. And as you know, I did the street retreat and a bunch of other stuff. So that was my first background. I'm probably leaving some stuff, but then later on, the Heart Circle Sangha in Ridgewood, Joan Hobrix Roshi was the leader of. I worked in prisons with a program that she had created, teaching meditation and giving people a place to listen to the things that they were going through and maybe making connections in the practice of meditation and how that would work. And anyway, so on. But I've been in a variety of ways, to make a long story short, involved in social engagement. So it's always had a place in my heart. And particularly, you know, with Bernie, it's sort of one of the connections was made between the practice and me taking social action. So now I know through time, I have mentioned any number of times the Zen Peacemaker Order and the tenets of the Zen Peacemakers. And and have used it as a frame of reference for any number of talks and for just not even the classic social engagement, but just as a guide to living our lives, being in the world with other people. So having said that, I'm not going to talk about social engagement from the Zen Peacemaker way, because I've done that a lot, but just a couple of other, two different things which I've brought together for that purpose. So two things. One is I'm going to talk about first, very briefly, the Bodhisattva ideal. Now on the altar is a statue of Kuan Yin, who is one of the most revered Bodhisattvas. And Kuan Yin hears the cries of the world, and she has committed her life to helping others, those who are suffering. And so originally the idea of helping and the Bodhisattva was looked at as a person who gave up enlightenment and instead helped others. Now the reason that that worked the way it did was in the mythology of Buddhism, there was a cycle of birth and death. You died, you came back in a new form, and that's how it went. Now that cycle would end when somebody became enlightened. They would step outside of that process of birth and rebirth. So a Bodhisattva would give up taking that final step, would give up enlightenment and stepping out of the circle of birth and death so that they could remain behind and serve others. Because if they stepped out, then they wouldn't be present to step up to help others. So the idea was that the Bodhisattva was someone, as I said, who devoted their life to saving others and gave up becoming enlightened. Now that's out of mythology, and whether you believe in birth or death or not, there was a subtle change that took place where a Bodhisattva was someone who cared about others and devoted their life in service to others, but it wasn't grounded anymore in not getting enlightened for that purpose, because there were many Bodhisattvas, or there are many Bodhisattvas, who are enlightened. So there was that shift. But the original shift and the original understanding of the Bodhisattva came out of Buddhist mythology. So I'm going to just bring two different things, a different approach to this beside the Zen peacemakers. I'm going to talk about a koan, and I'm going to talk about the Bodhisattva ideal. And again, briefly, there's a poet monk, Shantideva, who speaks of Bodhisattvas as beings, quote, to whom the suffering of others is as important as the things that they themselves hold dear. And he also says, all those happy in the world are so because of their desire for the happiness of others. So as I said, who is a Bodhisattva? There could be, whatever it is, 12 Bodhisattvas sitting here. Right? There is nothing special about a Bodhisattva other than their devotion to relieving or help relieve the suffering of others. So anybody can be a Bodhisattva. Now, in Mahayana Buddhism, the Bodhisattva is someone who has taken a vow to put others first. Now, this is in the context of Buddhism. So in the context of Buddhism, it's someone who has taken a vow to put others first. And ordinarily, if you think about it, we are self-centered beings. We tend to think of ourselves first and are primarily concerned with our own happiness. And as we take the first steps in our Zen practice, however, we bring along with us in these first steps, the me first attitudes, and our goals for practice and our improving our own lives, becoming happier, wiser human beings. And as our practice continues, we develop a greater sense of compassion and selflessness, right? So there's this shift where we're no longer practicing only for our own personal benefit, but we are subtly and slowly practicing so we can benefit others. So we realize that true happiness comes from ensuring the happiness and the well-being of others, and that, like us, all beings want to be free from pain. So we naturally, through practice, become open-hearted and inclined more and more to help others. So we're stepping out of ourselves, our small selves, and we're seeing that the self is much greater than how we were raised and our experience taught us it was, right? Which means that if you suffer, I'm suffering. So it's like the old story about Bernie Glassman. You hit your hand, immediately the other hand comes to its attention. Well, it's the same thing. The bodhisattva doesn't think. The bodhisattva's mind is open. And the natural response is to help, to serve. Now, the bodhisattva ideal starts with the smallest acts of loving kindness and concern, brief moments of putting others before ourselves, cooking a meal for a friend who's ill, listening open-hearted to a neighbor who's suffering, giving someone a ride when it's out of our way. Now, some people devote their entire life to service of others, to loving kindness. And these people usually have become famous, right? So there are some people who devote their lives to this. But there are the rest of us who, to varying degrees, take action to serve others. You know, and the people that are well known, of course, are people like Thich Nhat Hanh, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, Bernie, who I just mentioned, the Dalai Lama. These are people who devoted their lives to the service of others. But we can devote our lives to the services of others within the confines of our own particular circumstances. You know, somebody who has a family and kids, it may very well be that the amount of time and energy that they have to do this kind of work is limited. So the idea is that we each do the best within our own limitations, serving of others, and that this desire comes naturally out of practice. Again, as I say, the idea of who we are becomes greater and greater and greater beyond just our individual self. All right, so that's the bodhisattva ideal. This area of the bodhisattva, I mean, there are thousands of books written about this, papers written about it, discussions, talks. I mean, it's a very rich and fertile area in Buddhism. So this 5 minutes is, you know, not even scratching the surface. But what I tried to do, which is my nature, because I'm not, I would never make a good college professor. I tend to be very practical. So I look at these things as terms of, it's not my nature to study it and want to give long talks about it. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that at all, but it's my own nature is to take this. So that's another aspect of in my own life as a Zen person. I've done these kinds of jobs that basically took the bodhisattva ideal and put it into practical use. So this is a koan, which also looks at this, a little bit different direction, but the same thing. And it's koan 46 in the Mumen Khan. And I think I've probably talked about this before. And that's the koan about what do you do when you get to the top of the 100-foot pole. So Master Sakiso said, how will you step forward from the top of a 100-foot pole? And another eminent master of old said, even though one who is sitting on the top of the pole, a 100-foot pole, has entered realization, right? We start down looking up at the pole and then slowly climbing up the pole and then slipping back, and slowly over time we work our way to the top of the pole, and now we're on the top of the pole and we're looking down. So there's a trap. So this koan is expressing two things. First, when we take up practice and we sit wholeheartedly, we will eventually experience getting to the top of the pole, becoming enlightened. So what one of the dangers is that when we get to the top of the pole, we get tricked into, or we let ourselves believe that we have now accomplished something. And subtly, that makes us different than somebody else. We are enlightened. And those people down there, this is metaphorically, of course, these people down there are not yet as accomplished as we are. So if we think this way, when we're at the top of the pole, we will create a big problem. And the problem is becoming self-centered again, right? This big self that we've experienced, you know, slowly our mind creates the problem, which starts to get smaller and smaller and self-centered again. So it doesn't end when you get to the top of the pole. So taking a step off the pole is about becoming free. Free of self-centered ideas, free of concepts like attainment, enlightenment, being special, making it to the top. Right? Those all bind us. Those are all traps. And so we keep pouring ourselves out, and in doing so, again, become free of all these confines that we create for ourselves. So the question is, you know, what is there to hold on to? The only thing to hold on to are the delusions that our mind has created. Once we let those go, once we let those be silent, we are in a much better place. Now, another thing that getting to the top of the pole has been talked about is it's incomplete in a different way. And it's not enough. They always use the analogy of being a monk in a temple on the top of a mountain, right? And you have this wonderful, grand enlightenment where the world becomes so beautiful and you're just a part of it and everything is included, but you sit around in the temple. Well, that really doesn't take advantage of that experience. So one of the ideas is that you have to step off the top of the pole and enter in back into the everyday world. John Daido Luri of the Zen Mountain Monastery, he was the Roshi that started that monastery, said, "The Zen student who is stuck in the vast, serene condition of non-discrimination must be able to take another step to become mature." So the student must take a step off the pole into the marketplace. The student must actualize this insight in their daily lives. When someone steps on their foot on a busy street, or when their mother-in-law interferes in their marriage, or their teenager defies their wishes, or somebody cries out in pain, how do you respond? Right? You're no longer in a monastery, you're in the city, with all the bustling activity that takes place in a city. Can you see others as yourself? So the challenge is, can we step off the pole and live out our insight in our everyday lives compassionately and with an open heart? So, the other trick here is You don't have to wait to be enlightened to step off the pole. Somebody who's a third of the way up the pole, with whatever insight and open-heartedness you've gained, you can still go onto the streets and into your family and use the insight, the sights that you've acquired, to be a good family member, to be a good mother, father, somebody's son, right? So it's not an all or nothing thing. You know, you don't have to wait until you get to the top of the pole and then you, you know, enlightened, and then you get off the pole and you go into the marketplace. No, all of us can be bodhisattvas, and we do it within our own particular means, right? With what, however we've developed as human beings, we can offer that to serve somebody else. So I guess the best advice is, in terms of taking up this subject of helping others, serving others, is at a small sangha in Montclair, New Jersey. Can we and how do we step off the pole? And how do we take advantage of those of us who are in a position to do this kind of activity? And as I said before, no, some people are not inclined that way. Some people don't have the space in their lives or their own ability themselves to do it. But I'd like to at least put the idea out there of helping others and using our practice to do that. So that's what I would like to be the discussion in the practice circle period. And I'd like to ask Bernie and Marina if you would just lead that discussion, maybe give a little history of our communication. Well, thank you.